Now, the one who protects us all from prattling prognosticators and perfidious pundits.
I say, America, stay out the bushes.
Look for the Union Naval.
As to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government.
From my cold, dead hands.
I'm concerned that if we don't impeach this president, he will get reelected.
It's time for the Alan Nathan Show. Here he is, the longest-running nationally syndicated centrist host in the country, Alan Nathan.
Welcome, everyone, to the Alan Nathan Show, the home of militant moderation, where we live by our dear friend Alan's creed. Folks, we want the Republicans out of our bedrooms, the Democrats out of our wallets, and both out of our First and Second Amendment rights. I'm John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor of Breitbart News, your host today. Please visit our website at alannathan.com for our podcasts and our show times. Well, a lot going on in elections today. We're going to spend much of our time discussing that, making our predictions, and discussing with various people how things came to be. A couple of closer races out there, a couple that don't look really close, maybe a last-minute surprise, who knows. It's election day, so past is prologue now, and it's time to just see how things shake out in these closely watched races in Virginia and New York and New Jersey. But we also need to take a moment to acknowledge today the passing of a legendary figure in American politics, a very controversial figure in American politics, and that would be Dick Cheney, who was the vice president under George W. Bush. He was the Secretary of Defense under Bush the Elder, and obviously a man with a long shadow. He was in Washington for a long, long time. Did you know his first job in Washington was during the Nixon administration? That's how far back Dick Cheney went. And he also had quite a reputation in business as an oil man, as an entrepreneur, bouncing back and forth between business and politics. That's one of the things that some people admired about Dick Cheney, and that's one of the things that some people loathed about him. I guess if you're a little younger, his day had pretty much gone and you don't remember him as well. But if you were paying attention to politics during the 9/11 era, particularly the Bush administration, after that, the war on terror, Dick Cheney was a looming large figure and very strange for a vice president in that he was extremely powerful and motivated. That is probably the most common word that you will see in discussions of Dick Cheney today, in his obituaries, his encomiums, his eulogies. Powerful is the word they throw around, because he was. I mean, the guy had an amazing amount of influence as a vice president, and we have seen some other vice presidents who, shall we say, were not as effective as Dick Cheney. I won't name names, but there's a few. let's say most of them have not risen to his level of being involved in things. And if you remember the Bush days, there was a time when I think a lot of people, including a lot of Democrats, a lot of people on the left, were pretty darn glad that Cheney, being this intelligent, motivated, effective man, was the vice president, had gotten onto the George W. Bush ticket. And here comes the war on terror. Here comes 9/11. And, you know, later on in his life, he was caricatured as being Darth Vader. They often refer to him that way. He thought that was funny. He laughed when people called him Darth Vader because he was supposedly the sinister presence. But man, after 9/11, you really wanted Darth Vader in the White House. You wanted that. And a lot of people were glad to see him there. And that didn't last, of course. So a lot of controversies ensued. If you remember Dick Cheney from the War on Terror, you might not remember the final act of his life in politics, which was last year. He turned very decisively against President Trump and the Trumpified Republican Party. He cut an ad for his daughter, Liz, who is in politics. And in that ad, he described President Trump as the greatest threat the Republic had ever seen. And he called him a coward and just was as nasty as he could be to President Trump. And that was his final moment. After that, he was pretty much in private life until he passed away from heart problems. He had been fighting heart problems his whole life. He had a heart transplant in 2012. So he'd been dealing with that for a long time, finally caught up with him at the age of 84. But that was kind of the, I guess, from the Republican perspective, kind of the sad trombone ending of the Cheney legacy, because he endorsed, well, I said I wasn't going to name people who were bad vice presidents, so I won't. But he endorsed somebody who was not the kind of person he was in the vice presidency. And that was all Republicans really needed to hear as far as they were concerned. For a lot of younger conservative Republicans, they remembered Dick Cheney as a traitor He's a guy who turned against the party in its hour of need, almost consigned America to a horrific administration that he would have supported. And why? You know, why did he do that? And I think no small part of the reason why, his reasons and his family's reasons, that you have to ask them why they do some of the things they do and say. But I think from having watched Cheney for a long time, he was really rattled by January 6th, by the whole aftermath of the 2020 election and what happened on January 6th. That got him in a place, a vulnerable spot. And he had seen himself, I think, as a servant, a defender, a champion of a system in Washington. He had served his whole life, except for the times he was in private service, private business, in between his many government jobs. And after all that time, I think he looked at what was happening on January 6th, and he just thought it was appalling. You know, it was just, it really rattled him, and it made him angry. And he was angry at President Trump for not doing enough to stop that or to denounce it or distance himself from it. And I guess probably some words were exchanged at this echelon of politics. People do talk to each other. So whether or not it's on the record, maybe there were some harsh words exchanged between Team Cheney and Team Trump at some point. But that, and you know, Liz Cheney, his daughter, became the great anti-January 6th crusader. That's what she devoted what I guess was probably the final act in her political life to, was all the January 6th aftermath. So I think it was personal for Cheney. He'd been around a long time, and he never wanted to see anything like what he saw at the Capitol that day, and he just kind of saw red. And he's a pretty vengeful guy. If Dick Cheney didn't like you, just ask the people who were afraid of him. He was a devoted, dedicated, fearless opponent for good and for ill. But man, you cannot understand the history of the 1990s, the 2000s, the war on terror, Desert Storm under George Bush the Elder, the first President Bush. Cheney was the Secretary of Defense during that. You really can't understand that era of the late 90s and 2000s and into the Bush presidency without looking at Dick Cheney and the effect that he had on decision-making at that time. But by all accounts, I mean, a lot of people knew this man over the many, many years he was in Washington. He worked for a lot of people, worked with a lot of people, and not everybody loved him. But everybody really spoke highly of how perceptive and intelligent he was. And we need that, you know, perceptive, intelligent people, even if they reach conclusions that you disagree with. That's a talent you want more of in government. And there's that business of him being mixed up in the oil industry. And now for people that approved of Cheney and his approach, they said, well, good, we want businessmen in Washington, don't we? We have one as the president now, don't we? Isn't that great? We want businessmen. But on the other hand, you look at the fusion of politics and business, and there's a lot there not to like. You know, so a lot of people are concerned at how tight big business and big politics have gotten. And Dick Cheney was emblematic of a figure that lived in both worlds, basically moved back and forth between big business, big politics, megabucks, business deals, gigantic government programs effortlessly, like he was changing a suit of clothes. And again, for some people, that's good because you want government to be run by people with private sector experience who know how to get stuff done and have a record of accomplishment. And on the other hand, you look at how tight business and government have gotten over these many years. And after Cheney, I mean, look at the Obama years and how you had big businesses in the time since then, not just under President Obama, but in the years afterwards. Big business in many ways has become an adjunct of government and of its ruling party. That's what woke is all about. You know, the whole pushback against woke and DEI, that was big business being co-opted not just by the government, which would be bad enough, but by one party, the Democratic Party and its ideology, turning big businesses into their instruments of their will, of enforcing power against the American people that the Constitution forbids them to do directly. So they get their pals in big business to censor you and shut you up and deplatform you and so on. And that all goes back to that fusion of business and politics. Business and politics mixing does not necessarily mean a government run efficiently at a profit by skilled businessmen. In fact, it usually doesn't mean that. It's more likely to go the other way and for government to begin extending its influence through business and big money. And that's not good. I mean, that's we're suffering from a lot of that negative influence today. And then there's the war on terror and our complex feelings about all of that. And especially on the Republican side. Today, there are a lot of younger Republicans, conservatives, a lot of President Trump's enthusiastic younger supporters who do not think well of Iraq or Afghanistan, of the war on terror, of the operations there. And that was all Dick Cheney. I mean, more than any other person, you'll see a lot of the articles about him today describing him as the architect of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, especially Iraq. Like, that wouldn't have happened if Cheney had not willed it so. So, I mean, there are a lot of complicated feelings now about that war. Younger Republicans, people who have grown up and become conservative in the time since 9/11, and of course, today it's 2025, so those people are old enough to vote now that were born after it. They do not look at that war on terror with a fondness. They see that as a point where a lot went wrong with American government, with the Republican Party, with conservatism, and they feel like we're paying prices for those wars that were far beyond anything that Dick Cheney and his other advisors of President Bush would have anticipated. So, you know, a lot of feelings, I think, will be explored over these next couple of days as we digest the Cheney legacy. But for now, farewell to former Vice President Dick Cheney. I'm John Hayward. We'll be right back with more of The Alan Nathan Show.
According to a 2025 annual study by National Student Clearinghouse, more than 43 million people have some college credit but no degree. Devin Andrews, Vice President of Admissions and Evaluation at University of Phoenix, explains how to leverage prior college credit and pursue that degree.
Not everyone follows a straight path from high school to a college degree, but a University of Phoenix survey found that 33% of working adults don't realize that their college coursework might still apply toward a degree. Completing a degree can open doors to career enhancement, and previous college credit could count toward a degree, with the potential to save both time and money. Start by documenting your learning, check colleges or universities to see if they have clear policies on transferring credit, and look for tools that might help you assess your program time and cost.
Check out the University of Phoenix mobile app, TransferPath, and download it for a free pre-evaluation of transfer credit.
Across the country, thousands of military families are facing a devastating hardship during the government shutdown. Before October 1st, one in four active duty families already struggled to afford groceries. Military Family Advisory Network CEO Shannon Razadin.
When the shutdown entered its second week, we started hearing from military families who were incredibly nervous about their paycheck and if they'd be able to put food on the table. That's why we launched MFAN's Emergency Grocery Support Program. Within the first 72 hours, more than 50,000 military families applied for grocery support.
MFAN is calling on Americans to join the response and to donate. You can visit combatmilitaryhunger.org.
We feel that no military family should have concerns around putting food on the table, and we know that so many Americans share that belief. Please join us by donating at combatmilitaryhunger.org, and we will make sure that the groceries are delivered to the military families who need it most.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
Your daughter just had her first breakup. Do you A, put yourself in her shoes?
How could he do this to you? And for Sheila, she has split ends.
B, console her.
Oh, sweetie, this is going to happen a lot. Four, maybe five more times before you get married.
C, take charge.
Got to get this all straightened out. Give a little talking to man, mano a mano. Hey, Steve. It's now a good time? No? Okay, no problem. Bye.
Or D, help her find a new boyfriend.
I know a great place to meet boys. The internet. Nice, single boys. Never mind. How about some ice cream?
As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
The mission of Paralyzed Veterans of America is clear. Accessibility. Veterans who have served and sacrificed the best of themselves deserve access to the best our country has to offer. Access to meaningful employment. Access to the veterans' benefits they've earned. Accessible homes and vehicles. And access to every part of their communities. With PVA staff working inside VA hospitals, no other veterans organization has provided more real-time, ongoing support for paralyzed veterans and their families. PVA is proud to serve veterans across all branches, all generations, and all conflicts. Our nation's heroes fought for your independence. Join PVA in fighting for theirs. at pva.org.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News. One of the closely watched races being decided today on Election Day is the New York City mayor's race, where it seems all but certain that Socialist Zoran Mamdani is going to win, barring any big last-minute surprises from his remaining principal rival, a former Governor Andrew Cuomo. How did the New York race get to be where it is? And how, you know, the rest of the country is watching this, how can people in New York be getting behind somebody like Zoran Mamdani? I mean, there's an awful lot of reasons to be very nervous about this guy as a political candidate. Here with us to talk about it is Peter Lumaj, Republican strategist and a Fairfield-based attorney who immigrated to the United States from Albania. Welcome to the Alan Nathan Show.
Thank you for having me, sir.
I mean, I'm sure everybody with the perspective of having some familiarity with socialism, communism, looks at Zoran Mamdani and says, oh God, here we go again. They're going to vote in another socialist who makes all kinds of promises, and it's going to end in blood and tears and poverty, just like it always does.
No question about it. Every promise that he's making, he's not going to be able to keep it. This is how socialism starts, actually. It starts with promises that they sound good when you hear them, such as, you know, he's going to nationalize, or at least, you know, if for lack of a better term, he's going to have government-run grocery stores. He's going to freeze the rent. I mean, it sounds good when he talks about these things, but he forgets that he's going to have to go through the legislative body in Albany to do this if he were to do any one of these things, including free bus rides or train rides that he's promising the voters. He's completely misleading them, and this is what socialists do. They are very good at misleading the voters until they gain power. The moment they gain power, they know that they cannot deliver, and that is going to be another disaster for New York City when he cannot deliver what he's promising, because you're going to see thousands of New Yorkers who can afford to leave New York if he implements any one of these, what he's promising. If he's going to implement it, you're going to see thousands of New Yorkers who can afford to leave New York City and most likely approach move to the lower Fairfield County in Connecticut and Westchester County, New York.
Do you think there is some portion of the electorate in New York City that basically knows everything that you've said there and understands that, and they're just convinced that the legislature and so on will stop him from doing the crazy stuff he says? So for that reason, they don't feel threatened by him. They just figure he's making a lot of noise and saying a lot of wild things to get the kids excited. But at the end of the day, he won't be able to do any of the really dangerous things he talks about.
Yeah, I think that most of the informed voters, actually, they understand that there's a process to go through that he's going to have to go through, because New York City is part of New York State. He's not going to be able to independently decide what he's promising the voters he's going to do. And I think that most of the informed voters, they understand that he's not going to be able to deliver when it comes to, you know, implementing all these disastrous policies that he's talking about. And yeah, I think that, you know, even though it's kind of perturbing to see someone as, you know, as extreme as he is and as extreme as he portrays himself to be, completely socialist, and he's got other extreme, you know, ideas in addition to being a socialist. But I think at the end, you're going to see the commonsensical Democrats not endorsing him. I mean, we saw President Obama didn't endorse him. We still see that Chuck Schumer didn't endorse him. You're going to see other Democrats that are going to say, hold on a second, we're going too far with this socialistic thing in New York City. It was a 34-year guy who just, you know, became an American citizen 7 years ago. He's never produced anything. He's never run a business. He's never created a job. And I'm going to trust him to run New York City the way he thinks he's going to do it. I don't think he's going to go that far, or the Democrat Party is not going to allow him to go that far. If they allow him to implement these policies in New York City, that is going to be used as an example of failure for the Democrats. I mean, the center-right or the common-sense Democrats, they are threatened right now. They are scared of these extremists in their party, the left-wingers, including Mamdani, including Ocasio-Cortez and others, that they feel that, or they fear that they are going to be primaried in New York by some of these, you know, extreme left-wingers in their party. So I think that you're going to see a lot of negotiation or a lot of almost a civil war is going to happen within the Democrat Party, especially in New York, that they are going to have to root out these extreme elements in their party. Otherwise, the Democrat Party is going to be a complete failure, not only in New York, but it can be a failure nationwide. and it's not going to have the strength and the political, you know, power that it used to have.
You know, you can't really understand the rise of Zoran Mamdani without looking at his opposition. You've got Andrew Cuomo, not a well-loved figure that nobody is very excited about, and it did not leave his previous office exactly in triumph, and he's the primary candidate running against him. So you know there's not a lot of pro-Cuomo sentiment out there. And then you have Curtis Sliwa in the race, and whatever else you can say about him, he's never polled higher than like 15%. So some aspect of Mamdani's rise has got to be the lack of enthusiasm around the alternatives.
The Democrats have no one else to blame but themselves. And if you were to point out exactly who is to be blamed every year is Cuomo, because he ran a horrible primary campaign. He stood for nothing. He was a failure when he was a governor. He had to resign and, you know, because of the allegations filed against him. I mean, he was a horrible candidate. And now all of a sudden he becomes independent. He's not energizing the base. We're hoping that the older folks who are voting and have turned out to vote in early, you know, the other days, we're hoping that they are leaning towards him because, as President Trump said, I would rather have a bad Democrat than have a communist run New York City. So I think he would be a better option if the voters see that we're still counting on them. And, you know, I mean, as I'm traveling all over the city and, you know, watching what's happening over here, I mean, the turnout is unbelievable in New York City. So we're just hoping that, you know, the more informed voters will make the right decision. And instead of, you know, electing Mamdani and having a socialist and extremist for the first time run the city, I think that they would be better served if they go with Cuomo.
Well, enthusiasm is so key to off-year elections, and President Trump kind of jumped into this at the 11th hour yesterday and told everybody to go out and vote for Cuomo and said, you know, he'd be better than the alternative. That's probably not going to work hugely well among a New York electorate that doesn't really like Trump to begin with, but also it's just there's no enthusiasm in strategic voting. When you're voting for somebody you don't really like just to keep a really awful candidate from taking office, people do not get up at the crack of dawn and stand in line all day to cast a vote like that, but Mamdani's supporters all seem pretty jazzed. Like, there's a lot of enthusiasm on his side from the people that support him.
Well, he definitely took advantage of it. I mean, the other two candidates, you know, Curtis Sliwa, he's a Republican candidate, but he's not, doesn't look like he's going to win. Doesn't have the support that he should have as a Republican. Republicans in New York City are almost non-existent. The Cuomo supporters or people, you know, Cuomo is not the candidate that they would have preferred to have. So Mamdani obviously took advantage of this. He pointed out Cuomo's failures in the past and the fact that he had to resign from governorship. And, you know, he took advantage of it. And definitely he's cashing in. He's energizing the younger generation that they believe that socialism is the solution to the challenges that they are facing. Most of these younger voters that have never held a job, they haven't paid taxes yet. They don't know the real world, if you will. And if you promise them free things and free housing and free buses and free food, and you know, the one thing that these socialists or the voters who are supporting socialism, they should learn one thing from the government shutdown: that when the government controls food, they starve you. And this is socialism, and they should see what happened with the government shutdown. So I hope
We will see how it goes. As they say, a government big enough to give you everything you want is also big enough to take away everything you have. And we may see that put to the test in New York in the days to come. Peter Lamage, Republican strategist, thanks very much for joining us today. I am John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News, your host today. We'll be right back with more of the Alan Nathan Show.
Tonum Health, T-O-N-U-M, Tonum Health, and the product is Motus, M-O-T-U-S. It's a multiple ingredient formula that not only addresses GLP-1 with appetite and insulin sensitivity, but it also addresses fat oxidation and metabolism, addresses cellular energy with NAD levels. And so what we see is not only fat loss, quite frankly, exceeding that of these GLP-1 medications, where 87% of the weight that's lost is fat mass. That's a stark contrast to those medications. But we see numbers of weight loss as well that are pretty dramatic, 10.5% across the 6 months with the 100 study participants, and 14.5% weight loss with those that are doing excellent diet and exercise. Tonum.com, T-O-N-U-M, Tonum.com, and the product is MOTUS, M-O-T-U-S.
Small businesses face constant security challenges, from protecting property to keeping employees and customers safe. Simply Safe is stepping in with a new suite of professional-grade security solutions designed specifically for business owners. TV host and entrepreneur Chip Wade has more.
As a business owner, I travel a lot for work, and it's reassuring to have a system that not only lets me monitor my businesses no matter where I am, but it's protected by trained agents who will intervene if there's trouble. It's about knowing my offices and workshops are protected even when I can't be there.
Simply Safe Business Security offers customizable plans backed by 24/7 monitoring. Key features include AI-powered cameras, live agents who can help prevent crimes and call for help in an emergency, multi-camera live streaming, customized user access, and elevated customer support.
Simply Safe aims to give business owners just like me peace of mind so they can focus on growing their businesses, all without long-term contracts or cancellation penalties.
To learn more, visit simplysafe.com.
Hi, it's Practical Polly's radio show. If you're just figuring out that healthier cooking oils are better than solid fats, you may be asking, now what am I going to do with all these tubs of lard? Ever had one of those moments when your favorite skinny jeans feel too tightly tailored? Generously apply lard to your hips and thighs and those fancy pants will slide on like a dream. Or here's a family-friendly idea. How about making your yard into a lard fun park? Frost your driveway with a nice thick coating and give those kiddos a downhill thrill no matter what time of year. Having a bad hair day? Yep. A little lump of lard can tame your flyaways in a jiffy. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste or to your waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Now that's a tip worth keeping for life. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
What are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
Well, what are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. Don't you remember me? Don't you know that we miss you?
Miss me? Who misses me?
You know, all your friends in the forest. The trees, the pond, that little fort that you made out of branches. We all miss you.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
The forest is not that far away. Have an adventure today. I'm sure your mom would take you.
You're right. I should get out. I want to have fun. Play in puddles, catch frogs, and climb trees. Hey, Mom!
Yeah, hon? Steven! What is that in your hand?
It's my sense of adventure, Mom. It's telling me we need to get out of the house and have some fun in nature today.
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp.
I can probably hit the green from here.
Probably.
Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News. Joining us now to take a look at today's races is Jeanette Hoffman, Republican strategist and president of Marathon Public Affairs, former executive director of the New Jersey Republican State Committee, and winner of the Carol Murphy Award by the Women's Political Caucus of New Jersey. Welcome to the Alan Nathan Show.
Hey, John. Happy Election Day.
Well, got to ask about New Jersey first. What do you think? How does it look over there?
We're ready to flip New Jersey red for Jack Cittarelli as our next governor. It's very exciting here.
Do you think that is in the cards? Does it look to you like he's got the win?
It's going to be close. It's going to be a nail biter. As you probably know, New Jersey has had a Democratic governor for 8 years. It's been a disastrous administration. Our property taxes are America's highest in the country. We have really skyrocketing energy rates. So I think people are ready to make a change. But it's going to be tough. We have a lot more registered Democrats here than Republicans. So we need to for Jack to get some crossover votes from independents and Democrats to make it happen. But I think he's going to do it.
It seems from the national perspective like that race slowly became a nail biter. At first, it didn't seem like it was the most exciting contest on the map. And then over these last couple of months, the polls tightened and tightened and tightened until it looked like it really was a jump ball.
Yeah, it really did. I mean, Mikey Sherrill is a really uninspiring Democratic candidate. Her only message is to, you know, she really detests President Trump, and that's really the only thing she's been running on. She really has no other message. She's basically running it like it's a 2018 congressional campaign to send a message to President Trump. But New Jersey voters are smarter than that. And frankly, the state has been trending pretty red over the past 8 years. Every month since Joe Biden's been in office, we've gained more Republican voter registrations and Democrats have lost them. And, you know, that just the past 4 years, we've gained over 166,000 registered Republicans, over 30,000 more registered Republicans in 2025 alone. President Trump did pretty good here. He only came within 5 points of beating Kamala Harris, and that's pretty historic here in New Jersey. So we're hoping to capitalize on a lot of those gains that President Trump won here last year in New Jersey and make a real big difference in the state and get us back to common sense.
Well, it seems like a common thread in all the races we're watching today that the Democrat candidates are running hard against President Trump and kind of competing with each other to be who the most vicious Trump critic can be, the most fighting fighter who will take the fight to Donald Trump. And obviously that is an effort to try to gin up some enthusiasm from their base. And in out-year elections, enthusiasm is very, very important. Do you think that's going to be the dispositive factor in some of these other races? I mean, Virginia is the one that really jumps to mind. Abigail Spanberger is like a comedic parody of a bad candidate. It almost beggars belief that anybody would vote for her. But last time I checked, she was 10 points up. And almost the only thing she has going for her is that she really, really, really hates Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, that is her sole message. I can't think of anything else that she's talking about. I mean, Virginia is a little bit more different than New Jersey because they had a Republican governor for 4 years. And sometimes people like to, you know, change the laundry, as you say, and change out the political parties. And they are closer to D.C., so they may be feeling some of the effects of the shutdown a little bit more closer than we are here in New Jersey. But, you know, I also think the Jay Jones situation down there is pretty deplorable. The fact that Abigail Spanberger kept Jay Jones, the candidate for attorney general, on her ticket after those disgusting, vile text messages about wanting to murder the speaker in Virginia, I think is disgusting. And I wish voters would send a message to that entire ticket. And, you know, she should have just dumped Jay Jones the second that whole scandal came out. But we'll see what happens. I mean, personally, I think you need to give voters something to vote for and something to stand for versus just being anti any politician.
Well, that's an interesting dynamic in Virginia. Last I looked, Jay Jones was in and may very well not win his race, but Abigail Spanberger seems to be almost completely insulated from him. It's like the voters there aren't holding it against her at all.
Yeah, it's bizarre how they just kind of cut her out of that whole scandal. I mean, it was a drain on the ticket a couple weeks ago, but it seems like she's cleared away from him and she has a pretty healthy lead. But, you know, maybe I attribute that to the dynamics of the shutdown that are happening in Washington, D.C., and a lot of federal workers not getting a paycheck right now.
I've heard it suggested more than once that one of the reasons the shutdown limped along as long as it did is that the Democrats thought it would help them in Virginia in particular, that they want the furloughed government workers out there at the polls, and that, sure enough, you know, stories are starting to pop that tomorrow, day after, maybe they'll finally be ready to make a deal and reopen the government.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. I mean, this Schumer shutdown is hurting a lot of people. And, you know, you've heard the second in command in the House, the Democrat House whip, basically say, well, this is the only leverage we have. And of course, real people are suffering, but this is the only time we have leverage to get what we want. So they basically said the quiet part out loud, that we don't care that people are hurting. We need to score some points against the Republicans and against Donald Trump. And that's exactly what's happening. That's exactly what they're doing. And I would just point to John Fetterman, the Democrat senator from Pennsylvania, who's probably the only voice of common sense in his party, when he says that Democrats are basically playing a game of chicken with the American people to try and score points. And of course, you know, Chuck Schumer is afraid of his extreme left party in AOC, and he's worried about a primary challenge from the extreme left right now. So all these dynamics are at play right now, and unfortunately, federal workers and the American people are suffering.
Well, according to the polls, and we always, you know, they may not be reliable, but based on what they're telling us, it looks pretty close as far as whether the public blames Republicans or Democrats for the shutdown, which is amazing because the Democrats are literally standing over the dead government with a smoking pistol in their hand, and still half the people say maybe the Republicans did it. But it seems like they do, and it's kind of hard to look at that and not come away with the idea that some of that is just people being grumpy at the administration or the Democrats successfully playing off public sentiment and casting this is kind of an anti-Trump issue more than a logical discussion of who shut the government down.
Yeah, and I think to a certain sense, people are just have just had it with all politicians in general, and they don't even know who to blame, that they're just so sick of it. You know, you go to the airport and you have 3-hour delays to check into TSA right now because people aren't showing up for work when they're not getting a paycheck, and who can blame them? So I think the American public just at large is sick of politicians in general, and they want this nonsense to end. But, you know, we know who's to blame, and it's the Democrats who can't get, you know, 5 Democratic senators to act like rational human beings and grown-ups and vote for something that they voted for time and time again, and that's a clean CR, nonpartisan, which is the gold standard to keep our government running.
Well, and then we have to turn to New York, and you would like to think that maybe the public is tired of political shenanigans and big government, but New York is about to vote an outright communist into power, and that's totalitarianism. I mean, they want free everything. The government's going to give them everything. He's going to take care of them like they were babies, with unlimited public spending and free buses and government grocery stores, and it looks like the voters in New York City can't get enough of that.
Yeah, and you're not being rhetorical when you say he's a communist. I mean, frankly, Mamdani has said he wants to seize the means of production, which is Marxist language, frankly. And you know what's also disturbing about that is so many very prominent rabbis in New York City, I think over 1,000, wrote a letter saying Jews in New York City, one of the biggest Jewish populations in America, won't feel safe and shouldn't feel safe with Mamdani as New York City mayor because he is normalizing anti-Zionist, anti-Semitic rhetoric in the things he says and not denouncing globalizing the Intifada. So it's a very disturbing thing, not just his policies, but his rhetoric, his extreme positions, and standing side by side with a unindicted conspirator of the World Trade Center bombing. I mean, this man is extremely dangerous. He's extremely far to the left, and this is, frankly, the new poster child of the Democratic Party. Hakeem Jeffries, the House Minority Leader, has endorsed him. So this is who the Democrats are going to have to answer for in the midterms.
Well, there's definitely that strain of anti-Trump sentiment in that race, because I think one of the top Democrats, it might have been Hakeem Jeffries, said that Mamdani is going to win and it's going to be a demonstration of our defiance and resistance or something like that. So that whole race has been cast as a battle against Orange Hitler. And the reason they're rallying around Mamdani is Trump doesn't like him. And they're probably going to regret doing that. But for right now, that seems like a powerful dynamic sweeping through that race.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Certainly there is some of that. But if you look at Mamdani, he is a very smooth, persuasive, charismatic, young candidate. I mean, listen to what Barack Obama said to him. He's so impressed by his campaign and his candidacy. I mean, but the man has just promised free everything to everyone. So, you know, you really can't believe what you see and hear in this candidate. And he's frankly very dangerous. And, I think it goes far beyond just anti-Trump rhetoric, because we're hearing that from pretty much every Democrat right now. But the things that Mamdani is proposing go far, far beyond just, defying the president's agenda.
Well, you mentioned the rabbis speaking out against him. I don't know if Mamdani is going to win the Jewish vote, but they certainly don't seem to be mobilizing in large numbers to stop him, do they? I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, no. And unfortunately, I don't know how any Jew in New York can vote for this, and someone who, won't denounce globalizing the Antifada, which means basically killing the Jews. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this all plays out. And it'll be, an interesting couple of weeks ahead of us.
Yeah, we will know the results of the races soon enough, I suppose, and then 1,000 spin pieces will be written, and we all get to enjoy
exactly.
The media telling us what it means. Jeanette Hoffman, thanks for joining us today. I'm John Hayward, your host. We'll be right back with more of The Alan Nathan Show.
Would you know where to turn if you or loved one suddenly became paralyzed? Paralysis isn't something you plan for, but the National Paralysis Resource Center has served as a vital lifeline for thousands of families. But federal funding for the program is at risk. Marine veteran Sherman Gillums Jr., Senior Director of Public Policy at the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, says the consequences could be devastating.
This is about more than just a budget line. It's about veterans, caregivers, and families, real people who need these resources to live more productive and independent lives.
Gillums, who lives with paralysis himself, says cutting this funding would remove critical resources like peer mentoring, help with housing, and job placement guidance.
When you take away these lifelines, people must figure out how to rebuild their lives on their own. And that's not something any family should have to do.
Learn about the importance of funding for the National Paralysis Resource Center at ChristopherReeve.org.
On Sunday, November 2nd, Americans will fall back to standard time, despite growing concerns over the health and safety risks of seasonal time changes. According to sleep experts, making standard time permanent could improve the lives of millions, and the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time and its partner, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, are working to make that a reality. Dr. Karen Johnson, sleep medicine physician and co-chair of the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time.
When our schedules align with the timing of natural light, people benefit from brighter mornings, safer commutes to work and school, and improved sleep at night.
Want to lessen the effects of the time change? Try these tips. Get at least 7 hours of sleep per night before and after the change. Adjust the timing of daily routines like meals and exercise, and head out for early morning sunlight during the week after the time change. For more information about ending daylight saving time and to find additional resources about sleep disorders, treatments, and sleep health, visit sleepeducation.org, sponsored by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm going to keep ticking, but no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times? When we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while. Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart and don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Know that feeling? Like every door is closing and you just can't see a way out? Being unemployed, underemployed, or just out of school feels a lot like that. But when you find the right tools, suddenly everything just clicks. Getting on that path may be easier than you think. A good place to start? Go to findsomethingnew.org. At findsomethingnew.org, you have access to resources that help develop new skills. Skills that will position you for careers in today's growing industries. From healthcare and manufacturing to cybersecurity and alternative energy. Plus, you can take advantage of online courses, certification programs, apprenticeships, and more. So you can take yourself from unemployed and uncertain to empowered and prepared for what's next. Find your path to a new career today. Visit findsomethingnew.org. A message from the Ad Council.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America. Our vets need you.
I'm a quadriplegic. I'm definitely at risk with my diminished lung capacity.
I have MS. I'm in a wheelchair, and I can't leave the house because I have a compromised immune system.
I'm very concerned about, would there be a bed for me? Would there be a ventilator for me? Would I be able to survive something?
It's just heavy. You know, it's a heavy moment.
This is a war. This really is.
Our veterans fought for us. Let's fight for them.
I am so grateful for the PVA. They're making sure that we have all of the food and supplies that we need right now.
We all gotta help each other right now. We can't get through this by ourselves.
It's with profound gratitude that you're going to be saving our lives.
To find out how you can help, please go to helppva.org. That's helppva.org.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News. What are we to make of these races that are being decided today, these elections? You've got Virginia Governor and Attorney General, which really attained national stature because the Democrat candidate, Jay Jones, wished death upon his Republican opponents and their children, and the Democrat hierarchy did not denounce him for that vicious, unacceptable language. Then you've got New Jersey governor, and you've got mayor of New York, of course, where Zahra Mamdani is in the lead. Of course, there's going to be, as I was joking before the break, 1,000 spin pieces, probably already pre-written, to be honest. They're all sitting in the word processor waiting for a few details to be finalized about what it all really means. And it's going to be cast as some kind of towering rebuke to President Trump. They're going to tell you that Trump was defeated all over the country yesterday, and this is a harbinger of the midterms are going to be a Democrat blowout and so on, which is a little silly because we're talking about Virginia, New Jersey, and New York City here for New York City mayor. None of those is really a place where the Republicans would normally do well, even under the best of circumstances, and they are doing well in New Jersey. Jeanette Hoffman just was talking about this. It is astounding the strength the Republican Party has shown in New Jersey in this race, even if they lose. That's really close. Could go either way. But even if they lose that race, they've made an amazing showing in a state that used to be written off as pretty much 100% blue and a state where Trump didn't do well in his presidential races. So, you know, that's really, there's a different message there that the Republicans are gaining steam in places like that. New York City mayor, I mean, what can you say about New York City? It's a different world politically than any place else. But it is a closely watched race because of how extreme Zahra Mamdani is. And of course, 1,000 think pieces will be written, assuming he wins as he is projected to, about how everything has changed and he's now the leader of the opposition and a new day has dawned for Democrats. And one reason they're going to be so eager to write those pieces is that the Democrats have been doing very poorly with young people. Especially in this last election cycle, younger people are turning strongly Republican. They much favored Trump during the last race. That had Democrats badly spooked. So if they can win in New York with a young, youthful candidate, that's going to be the story. You know, youth is back and Democrats are the party of the young again, blah, blah, blah. That's like I said, those pieces are already written and the editor is just waiting to hit publish as soon as the results of the election come in so they can deliver that spin. What are you to make of the Jewish vote? In cases like this, we're talking about that. I mean, how can Jewish people be okay with Zahra Mamdani winning? You know, he literally said globalize the Intifada. That means kill Jews. How can they be voting for somebody that wants him dead? And of course, part of the answer is that for a lot of cosmopolitan left wingers, of which Jews tend to be, you know, so it's really not just Jewish people here. It's just people of the left living in urban environments. They are very eager to demonstrate how progressive and not racist they are every chance they get. And so for a lot of those people casting votes in New York City, there is a real thrill, I think, that will come for them with voting for the Muslim candidate to prove how progressive and open-minded and totally not racist they are, even when the guy wants to globalize the Intifada. And, you know, realistically, it probably isn't going to be Zahra Mamdani out there shooting people in the streets, but he's going to create an environment where the people who do that sort of thing feel welcome because he wants to globalize the Intifada. So you're going to have a lot more people invested in political violence are going to feel energized because he was able to win and not suffer after saying something like that. It's really dangerous. It's incredibly dangerous to let a candidate win after using the kind of rhetoric that he's used. But for people living in an urban liberal environment, that none of that matters that much. To them, they just want to prove how progressive they are by voting for this unlikely candidate. And they want to give the big middle finger to Donald Trump. And they know he doesn't like Zahra Mamdani and Zahra Mamdani hates him. So this is their big gesture of defiance and resistance that they're going to get by voting for him for mayor. And then there's the Santa Claus effect, all the freebies that he promised. None of that will happen and none of it will work. But they won't hold that against him because they'll think he cares a lot and he really, really tried. That's how socialism gets by. Socialism is in such a weird place
right now because people that are older keep telling voters it doesn't work. I mean, it's a disaster every time it's tried. And you can even explain why. And it doesn't matter because socialism gets unlimited do-overs, no matter how much a disaster it makes around the world, no matter how many times it crashes and burns. Socialism always gets another turn at bat because the people pushing it always claim they can deliver everything for free. And they always tell you the only reason you're not getting everything for free right now is because evil, greedy people are hoarding all the money and all the wealth. And they're going to go get it. They're going to go get it from all those evil, greedy billionaires. And they're going to give you free everything and free groceries and free this and free that. And man, that is never not going to sell. It doesn't even matter how bad you are at selling that message. You can be a very stumble mouth person, not a gifted public speaker. I mean, Zahra Mamdani is. He's a good public speaker by any objective definition. But you don't have to be. You can be two left feet on stage. And if your message is still, I'm going to go get evil rich people's money and buy free stuff for you, you're going to get 30, 40 points automatically in any race you run just by selling that. It's a pity. People never really understand why that doesn't work. And one of the reasons it doesn't work is because socialism is compulsive. It requires coercive force. It is the antithesis of freedom and democracy. People do not give up their money voluntarily. You have to take it from them, which means you have to use force against them. And if they don't want to do what the socialist overlords think they should be doing, they have to be forced to do things differently. And before very long, the socialist, after he wins his big commanding victory, another election or two down the road, the socialists start saying, you know, we really can't have elections anymore. Not like that. You can't vote against our truths. We're socialists. We know what's right for you. You can't vote against what's right. We can't allow that. We can't have people casting wrong votes out there. So the number of things that you're allowed to vote on starts diminishing. And before you know it, democracy is gone. But it all starts out with people saying they want to give you free stuff. And isn't that wonderful? And, you know, you also have to look at these races and think about the midterm tide. And if I were a Republican strategist, you know, and some of our guests today are people who are, that's what I would be talking to the Republicans about right now. It is a simple fact that off-year elections tend to favor the party that's out of power, almost invariably, in the modern age. And it's not hard to see why. The party that's out of power has the enthusiasm. I mean, it's very unlikely that whoever won the last election is going to deliver everything they promised and usher in paradise on earth. So there's always going to be people that are a little unhappy with the way things are going. And that means the party in power, the party that holds the White House, is going to have an enthusiasm gap. Their people are not going to be as motivated to run out to the polls as the people who are unhappy and out of power and hate the guy in the White House. It happens all the time. It's not new. So that is always a strong factor in these out-year elections. In this out-year election, there's a lot of personal animosity against President Trump, a lot of people that really don't like him. They can't wait to cast a vote against him. And I really think if you're the Republicans and you want to beat that trend, you need to get out there and talk about your issues. The Republicans were pretty weak during this election cycle for these governor and mayor's races about telling their political story. Well, you better start polishing that story up for the midterm races, guys. I'm John Hayward, your host today. Thanks very much for joining us on this hour of the Alan Nathan Show.
The opinions you hear on the Main Street Radio Network are those of the host, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of the station, Main Street Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Main Street Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. So please, consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about Main Street Radio Network, contact us at 703-719-0433 or at our website, mainstreetradionetwork.com.